Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Here we are for the Sanford Stem Cell Institute. We have 6 centers and a brain tumor and neurorestoration program. We started September 2nd of 2022. And I think we highlighted the topic of really having to communicate our ideas as scientists to the public. And how do we do that properly? And that's a huge point of consternation, but also an opportunity, I think, for all of us. So we'll hear from 3 experts here. Karen Christman will introduce the panel of our august editors here. And I'd really like to thank Karen Christman for co-directing our Advanced Therapy Center for the Sanford Stem Cell Institute together with Dan Kaufman. So thank you so much, Karen, for being here.
Great. Thank you, Kat. It's been, a great symposium so far. So before we get started on the panel, I just wanted to briefly introduce the center that Kat mentioned and talk about a little of our work, kind of how it's related to the center and translation. I will say, breeze through it a little faster than expected to get us back on time because we will end on time because I have to go teach a class in tissue engineering at 12:30. So we will end at 12:15. So I'm going to be a little quicker with my remarks so we can hear from our great editors. So as Kat mentioned, I'm co-director with Dan Kaufman of the Sanford Advanced Therapy Center. I believe he will give a short moderate and give a short talk tomorrow. But part of it is that really the part kind of the side that Dan directs is having services that can help with the development, testing, and GMP production of innovative therapy, so particularly for cell therapy. So I'll let Dan talk about that. From my side, I'm actually in bioengineering, so I'm very interested in advancing kind of regenerative engineering therapeutics through IND and then hand it off to the Stem Cell Center. So really, the Sanford Advanced Therapy is really trying to try to advance therapies through IND and then hopefully hand it off to the clinical center for translation. My disclosures. So a lot of what we do is designing injectable immune modulating biomaterials that are derived from natural extracellular matrix. So we take typically porcine tissue, we decellularize it, strip out all the cells, leaving behind just the extracellular matrix that is biocompatible. And instead of having a rejection response, despite being porcine tissue, as long as you decellularize it appropriately, it actually shifts immune cells from a pro-inflammatory environment in a disease state to a pro-reparative or pro-remodeling environment where you get reduction in typical fibrotic responses. And so we've made different types of processes for the injectable materials where we can take this decellularized ECM and then make it into an injectable form. So we can either use it as an injectable hydrogel, which for a hydrogel, for those of you who don't know, think of it like Jell-O, kind of a squishy, soft material. But you can inject into tissue, and then it self-assembles into a porous and fibrous network like you see in that picture, very reminiscent of natural extracellular matrix. And that stimulates cell infiltration, polarization of the immune response, and encourages endogenous repair. And it also increases stem cells in the location of injection. We've also developed more recently an infusible version of this where we fractionate it so you just get these small nanofibular structures that you can deliver directly into the bloodstream. And it will specifically target areas of inflammation and bind to regions of leaky vasculature, actually at the gaps in leaky endothelium to actually reduce vascular permeability, reduce inflammation, pro-survival, and also increases in vascular progenitors and stem cells. So we've done a number of indications that, again, I'm just going to kind of breeze through for sake of time. We've done a lot of work in the heart, which my lab particularly focuses on, and this has led to completion of a phase 1 clinical trial in myocardial infarction patients. So the material is supplied in a cake like this. You just add a lyophilized cake, you add sterile water, it's ready to inject, and you can deliver it via catheter minimally invasively into the heart. We showed initial safety and feasibility in patients. with the Sanford Stem Cell Institute, particularly the clinical center, we're about to start a new trial in CABG patients that can't be fully revascularized to stimulate vascularization in those regions. And also in collaboration with colleagues at Emory, have an IND-approved trial. Also will start next year in hypoplastic left heart syndrome. So on the bottom is just showing some of the data we have in a right ventricular heart failure model. And then we've done some other indications, actually, with the skeletal muscle-derived material for things like peripheral artery disease, where we increase blood flow and skeletal muscle progenitor cells. Also, tongue dysphagia in collaboration with Andrew Vahabzadeh-Ha, who's an ENT doc. Also, in collaboration with Mariana Alperin, who is here in the building as a practicing urogynecologist, been taking this approach for many indications in women's health. For example, regenerating pelvic floor muscles that are injured post-birth to try to reduce or eliminate pelvic floor disorders, as well as some newer indications for menopause and to treat some symptoms of menopause, such as genitory urinary syndrome. So that's with our hydrogels, and then as I mentioned, we have an infusible version that can be delivered either intracoronary in the case of, say, acute myocardial infarction, or even systemic intravenous. We have some data, nice data in a systemic inflammation model for multi-organ dysfunction syndrome showing improvements in animal survival, and you actually get drastic reductions in inflammation by infusing this extracellular matrix. So I like to think of this as, you know, basically truly minimally invasive regenerative medicine through intravascular delivery. So in collaboration with the company I co-founded, Ventrix, as well as Advanced Therapy Center, we're looking to really push many of these closer and through IND and then hand off to the clinical center for new trials in the upcoming years. Okay, so that's a very brief introduction. Sorry again for the speed. But with that, we'll transition to our panel, who are great editors who have come all the way here to join us and really, you know, get to see the whole view of the field of stem cells and regenerative medicine. And so just briefly to introduce everyone, so we have Sheila Chari, who is the editor-in-chief of Cell Stem Cell. We also have Stella Hertley, who is the deputy editor of Science. And then finally, Robert Stevenson, who is senior editor of Nature Communications, and are all involved in portfolios related to stem cells and regenerative medicine. So I have a few questions I'm going to get started with, and then I'll hand it over to the audience and have a chance to answer or to ask your own questions. So my first one is, you know, what are some of the latest advances that you're seeing come through in terms of stem cell sciences, and I guess also more broadly regenerative medicine therapeutics that you're seeing in academic publishing?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for including us in these discussions today. It's really great to be invited here. So I think of stem cell biology as including both foundational research, bioengineering, and regenerative medicine. And it's a really exciting time in all three of these subparts of our field. In terms of foundational stem cell research, we're at this wonderful moment where we've kind of circled back to really important fundamental developmental biology questions. And so stem cell scientists have really embraced these technologies, single cell technologies, and then bioengineering technologies to both look at fetal tissue and see what's happening in situ, as well as create these beautiful embryo models that are allowing us to ask about the earliest stages of human development, implantation, ask questions about what's different between humans and other species. So that's something that's been very exciting over the past year or so. I'm also seeing a lot of interest in the development of new bioengineering tools. I recently went to the Microphysiological Systems Society meeting, and that field has grown a lot. In just 3 years ago, they launched their society, and now it's really big. And you're seeing this excitement from the regulatory agencies in what bioengineering techniques can do. And so there's a lot of promise there that I hope that we as a field and can embrace, that developmental biologists can really start working with bioengineers to create human tissue models that could eventually potentially replace animals. in clinical testing. We see that with the FDA Modernization Act. There's a lot of support out there. So that really excites me. And then the last thing that you asked was about regenerative medicine. And so that has expanded so much in recent years. So in 2018, Kat and some of her colleagues here at UCSD published some of the first clinical trials that Cell Stem Cell published using stem cells. And that was really exciting for us. Now, only 6 years later, we are regularly receiving and publishing clinical trials using stem cells. And I just saw a analysis that showed that there are over 100 ongoing clinical trials with pluripotent stem cells now. That is incredible. So we are sitting at the precipice of learning a lot about what we can do with stem cells.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Would anybody else like to comment?
I think it's quite interesting because my take on the sort of stem cell field is it's not one field. And already today, the stem cells that we're talking about are not the stem cells that the general public worries about. And I think as a whole, these, I'd say at least four distinct fields, have matured incredibly quickly to the extent that I'd say we went through a phase of whatever, discovery, defining concepts, to refining basically the recipes that you use to generate the stem cell systems that you happen to want to work with, to now doing, you know, really detailed work on a variety of systems, both from the developmental point of view, from the medical point of view, from the reproductive medicine point of view. And I think it is quite hard, in fact, to decide which are the areas that that the real new advances are going to come from with respect to the sort of basic biology. I think we're at the stage where we are into the sort of translational phase, and that's burgeoning at an incredible rate. So at science, I don't really see that many, what would you say, pure stem cell submissions anymore. And I can't say whether that's good or bad, but that is, I think, a thing that I would say I definitely have noticed. And just with respect to science, I think the thing that when I go out and give talks about how you get a paper in science and all those sorts of things, one thing you can be sure of is you won't get a paper in science if you don't submit. So that's not to say we need or want an avalanche of submissions, but don't assume just because you know, you might not have seen your sort of stem cell work published lately in science, don't assume that means we're not interested. It can often mean you guys just aren't submitting. So think about that quietly, and we'll see where we get to.
Great advice. You got to shoot your shot, right, or you're not going to make it.
Actually, I'd add in as well. It's the same, I think, at Nature. I had a short stint there last year for about a year, and I think one of the lessons I learned moving from Nature Communications to Nature is just finding, like, if you really think you have a good advance, just give it a shot. And I think people probably also think, like, these clinical trials, maybe they would think to go more to a medical kind of journal. I think Nature is also quite interested in these papers as well. I think going back to these basic advances as well and thinking about single-cell RNA-seq and these single-cell technologies, so I think people probably immediately think about how atlases are being published, more and more, and we just get more cells and more coverage and so on and so forth. But I think, like, there's hidden advances coming out, and I think people are really leveraging these technologies to look at cell populations that we can't necessarily isolate and culture as well, which is really, really cool. And I think this is one of these kind of hidden big leaps that we've had in the field as well. So now, like, we know so much about pluripotent stem cells, and everybody knows all these epigenetic marks and how they interact with one another and how all the transcription factors interact proteomically and also on the genome as well. But we don't know this about things like skeletal stem cells quite so much, and all of their downstream progeny and intermediates. And we don't know about a lot of different cell types. And I think that this is actually something that's really, really opening up as well. So there are a lot of really cool insights about, like, the whole body as well.
All right, thank you.
So if you had to choose, you know, what is the one most significant, single most significant contribution that, in your view, to stem cell science and regenerative therapeutics, regenerative medicine, over the past year, what would you say that is?
There.
I know that's a tough question. You can maybe say two if you want.
Well, I can say what I think, and we didn't publish this paper. In fact, our colleagues at Nature Biotechnology published this paper, and it was making stem cells from stem cells. So there's a paper that was recently published, and there's been advances in this over the years, of the idea is to make long-term engrafting, multi-lineage hematopoietic stem cells from human iPS cells. And a paper came out earlier this year from Hanna Mikula and Andrew Elefanti that did this. And the reason I found this so exciting is because what they showed is that they are now getting the equivalent of cord blood. And so this really opens up the possibility of off-the-shelf products. And that's exciting as we learn more from other aspects of cell therapy like CAR T cells. We're seeing that these autologous approaches are not necessarily so simple, right? And they're not necessarily so safe. There was a paper that came out, I think, just a couple weeks ago showing lymphoma coming out of some of these CAR T cells. And so if we can really make off-the-shelf products that we can vet and manufacture and be very careful with, that will be huge. And this paper really excited me about that possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say for me, the sort of most significant paper, again, not a science paper, was the paper about making the embryo-like human embryo-like assembloids. I don't know what we want to call it these days, but I think that really stimulated people's imaginations about what we can do and how we can start to address human-specific developmental biology questions that have been and always will be quite difficult to look at. So I think that's a significant paper recently, and I'll stick with the one.
Okay, thank you.
I think also I was pretty fascinated by these human embryo-like models. I think it's a nice idea to add the word "like" in there as well, and it's kind of important. And this probably gets at one of the later questions about communicating with the public as well. And I guess they are like human embryos, I guess, in a sense. So these structures that form from embryonic stem cell aggregates. At the same time, I also found a paper by, I guess there were two papers by Lawrence Studer in Nature and Nature Biotechnology, quite fascinating. And I think it really kind of opened a door, and that was using a chemical cocktail, which he colorfully named Gen Tonic, to accelerate the maturation of neurons. So I think one of these big biological questions is how we control the clock, like the biological clock, whether it be it developmentally or whether it be in terms of maturation or in terms of aging. And it's really critical in terms of aging research, because if we want to use any of these things in a dish, which is really the best way to go, honestly, we need a way to speed things up. And then for aging research alone, that's particularly important, but it will also cut down things like production costs for tissues. We're still kind of in very early infancy for tissues. I think this will probably get another later question as well, and that's the fact that we're making tissues like pancreas or substantia nigra-like, I guess, clusters of dopaminergic cells. We're not making hearts or anything like that, and that's probably going to require a lot of innovation in terms of speeding processes up and scaling things. So I thought that that was kind of an open door, and it's also an aging model. I guess there are probably limitations to things like laminopathies in terms of modeling aging. So to be able to find something that looks a lot more like what's happening to us biologically, that's also really important. And there's probably not one way of doing that. There's probably going to be overlapping methodologies for doing this. So.
Great, thank you. So you mentioned communication. So my next question is, you know, are stem cell and regenerative medicine researchers effectively communicating the science, and how can we improve this communication to reach, you know, a broader audience? I think we all understand more and more it's important to reach not just a broader scientific audience, but also, you know, broader public, which was mentioned in the first talk this morning.
I think you're doing fine. I mean, I think it's the sort of area that, in fact, lends itself quite well to being communicated to the general public. I mean, everyone can understand that you need to renew, and that if things get broken, you need to fix them, and sometimes you need to add in replacement parts. I don't think it's that harder concept to translate to the general public. I think with respect to writing your papers, I think the important thing for, again, a journal like Science is to make sure that within your paper you introduce everything the person reading it needs to understand your particular paper. So you don't have to, you know, summarize the whole field, but you do need to make sure that, you know, all those acronyms are not assumed to be common knowledge, because they aren't. And to bring your reader with you, you do need to make sure that you basically don't lose them after the first paragraph because too many letters and no words.
My take on this is, yes, are we communicating stem cell science? Well, of course we are. I don't think we would have had the renewal of CIRM if we weren't really communicating well with the general public around what the value of stem cell research is. But we could be doing better. And I think the CIRM example is one that we should learn from. So there were a lot of questions about the promises that were made and whether or not we've delivered on them. And we live in a society that is a need for speed and wants immediate results. And it's hard to communicate science that is carefully done over very long periods of time. It is a brand new kinds of therapeutics, right? And the advances that we're making. So I think we could be doing a better job of not just focusing on the really wonderful, like, white knight cures like sickle cell. And of course, that is something we should be celebrating, but we need to be celebrating the incremental steps that we are making forward and communicating that to the general public. So like we mentioned before, there are 100 clinical trials going on in human pluripotent stem cell therapies. Those are still in very early stages, but what's so remarkable about them is that there are, as far as we can tell, no safety issues coming out of these trials, and that's something we need to be celebrating very loudly, right? Because we might not get to the curing of diabetes, although, you know, we have had some very interesting results from that for quite some time. So we need to make sure that we are celebrating our successes over this period of time so that the public is primed, right, and understands where we're going.
Great point. Do you want to come in?
I think there's one thing about talking about these grand papers as well. So I think there's the idea of promotion versus hype. So I think it's really difficult getting work published, and also people want to get excited about their work. And I think it's really important to keep the public excited about work as well, right? But at the same time, like this balance is really important. I think it's something we always have to keep in the back of our minds. So one of my great experiences at Nature last year was working together really hard with the journalists in the company and also with the authors and like listening to the reviewers as well. And I think when we're buried in our own research, we get really excited about things and we can see it with rose-colored glasses sometimes. And it's one of the great things about peer review is actually getting the input of reviewers and you know, seeing those places where things should be kind of toned down to an extent as well. So I think there were a few news stories which kind of blew out last year during the ISSCR, and it's not really clear how these came out, so talking about human embryo models, but one of the things that was really clear in these articles was that the papers weren't there, the preprints weren't there, and it was just word of mouth, and there's probably a lot of responsibility on this journalist in this case, because they were kind of, they were probably doing a bit of hype themselves as well, but I think that in that case, it was particularly inflammatory because it was talking about making structures that look like human embryos. And this is very much the kind of thing that during the George Bush Jr. years probably made, well, not probably, but absolutely made life difficult for everybody as well, and probably brought a lot of bad memories back. So once again, talking about human embryo-like structures, these things, they're not going to make an embryo at any time, and they're not going to proceed much further probably as well in those cases. It's probably not clear as well because there are very clear limits on these. But also, I think it's really important to keep the public excited. So, you know, I can think of in Soul Stem Cell, there was an early stage of a clinical trial where they have these iPS-derived pancreatic cells as well, in which case it's a safety study. So there was the indication of glucose secretion insulin secretion from the cells, but they're not talking about a cure of diabetes at the same time, right? It's a stage, and I think that's also another thing too. So it brings me into another point. I think that's like talking about the progression of science as well. So the public kind of needs to know that that's a really big step, and has to. We have to kind of keep the press, I think, from hold them back as best as we can from saying that diabetes is going to be cured next week. We have to make sure that those promises are a little bit down the line. I think also last week or 2 weeks ago, I guess, with these Nobel Prizes, I was really surprised by an article in The Guardian. And it was, so I guess they're talking about British scientists and Geoffrey Hinton, and I can't recall the other one, Dennis Hassabis. So these, Google DeepMind, I guess he's with. So both of these are these AI pioneers, or the godfather of AI, as in Geoffrey Hinton. And in which case, the article basically said, this is great, guys, but there were years and years of, there was years and years of work that went into this, right? So I think yesterday someone was also talking about the great progression of stem cell research since the establishment of human embryonic stem cells, and suddenly, like, we're transplanting these islets, pluripotent stem cell-derived islets into patients. But before that, there was so much other work that we don't think about. So all of this mouse work that went into looking at the pathways that are involved in pancreas formation, that all contributed to these trials that are ongoing now as well. So I think keeping this in mind, that's probably going to make life easier as well in terms of getting public support for things like funding as well. So,
okay, thank you. I think that's, you know, discussion about link to patients and the public is a good segue into the next question, which if you can comment on what you think are a few barriers to addressing the social impact of stem cell and regenerative medicine research.
You know, I think Tom Cech raised this point earlier today that we live in an era where there's a lot of mis and disinformation. And I think that's the most pressing challenge for us to combat that. And stem cells are so ethically charged, and there's so many different kinds of stem cells. And the political environment in the U.S., especially right now, is frightening. And so I think we have ceded some ground and failed to be as aggressive as the opponents of this kind of research to really to teach people about what's happening. I mean, there's clearly, we need to learn from the pandemic. There is an appetite for knowledge around science. I mean, everyone knows what RNA is now, right? That's incredible. And even about how clinical trials work. So there clearly the public wants to know, and yet if we just keep talking to ourselves, and if we think that just making all of our papers open access is going to somehow trickle down into knowledge for the general public to understand it, then we're gonna find ourselves in a bad situation. So I think we need to stop talking just to ourselves and start talking to the public more, and training our students to use their skills. I mean, Rob was telling me about all the great work that you're doing here of using social media, using other ways to communicate with the general public, and yeah, to stop using all the acronyms and the nomenclature. I think we have to take this really seriously. Wouldn't it be such a tragedy if we actually developed all these, cures, for lack of better, or treatments that are successful, and then people are afraid to use them, like we had with vaccine hesitation. So we need to make sure we're starting now.
Yeah, great points.
Yeah, I think the other a barrier that you were alluded to just before we came on air, as it were, was the financial barriers. So there's financial barriers with respect to the funding the research, and that is whatever, a clear and present danger all the time for as we develop these new approaches that are more and more resource intensive. AI will not solve these problems. But as well, when we do develop these treatments, they're beyond the reach of the ordinary person in the street that might be cured, but basically won't be cured, because you can't actually get these things out on a large scale, not in the real world as we live in it. And so I think we do need to think about how to make all the sort of products of this labor be more equitably distributed. And I don't mean just in the first world. The vaccines did get to less developed nations, but slowly and not efficiently and not effectively. I mean, there are treatments now that, things like, I don't know, treatments for cataracts or whatever. They're like brilliant for all of us. If we get cataracts, we can go to whoever and get our cataracts sorted out. But if you're in the developing world, a cheap drug that did the same thing would be much better, more appropriate, easier. With respect to malignancies, I think for many and most malignancies, surgery plus some sort of straightforward chemotherapeutic regime will always be the treatment of choice when money is in fact limited. So we have to be realistic what stem cell regenerative medicine ever can really achieve in the real world, even though it's exciting and has theoretical incredible possibilities. Will we ever really roll it out? Will it ever be sort of both reliable enough and, like I say, to be able to be scaled up enough to really help a significant fraction of people?
And then what happens when you cure people of diabetes as opposed to selling them a drug? Well, so Novo Nordisk is like one of these, it's a great company, but at the same time, a lot of their profits are driven by that. I'm not saying like they would, of course, but at the same time, that's a lot of profit. So what if you cure people with a one shot?
Right, but I mean, you're only going to cure type 1 diabetes, so there's a lot of us aging fatter than we need to be people that this isn't going to help, so I think they'll be fine.
Devil's advocate.
Yeah, I heard it. Both of you brought up manufacturing concerns. I think that's, you know, something really critical to think about, not necessarily on the fundamental research side, right when you're thinking about translation. As an engineer, I try to think about that a lot, but I think it's, both of you made, you know, great points, like thinking about even early on what can scale and reduce cost to more broaden these therapies. So the last question that I have, and then we'll open up to the audience, is what do you see as the biggest, maybe one or two challenges in stem cell and regenerative therapeutic research right now?
Reproducibility. I mean, you know, making anything reliable enough to risk putting it into patients. I think, clearly we're nearly there, but I don't think we can assume we're there. And the problems will come. I mean, when you think about, all you'll need is one person killed by some sort of regenerative approach that was regenerating something that wouldn't have killed them, but they die. That's the danger. I mean, so I think that's the challenge. I don't know that we'd have an easy or quick answer, but yeah, I think that's one of the challenges.
I think I would have probably gone for the cost and the production as well.
I think all of those are very good points. And then just going back to kind of a more fundamental question about our field, you know, the point that you made at the beginning about how we're actually kind of stem cells is five different fields, perhaps, right? And so you see that I think our field can be a little siloed. I think because of the ethical issues, because we've had some scandals, there's a lot of gatekeeping, and that is important to protect our field. But there's also then this kind of lack of building bridges. And I love seeing what your institution is doing with the bioengineering plus the therapeutics. Like, that's exactly the kind of work that we need to be doing, having more of in our field. And, you know, from the perspective of an editor and seeing the way reviewers talk about papers and whatnot, I see a lot of hesitancy around new people entering the field and new types of work entering the field. And I wish that we could find a better balance in this. So, you know, going back to organ on chip, those might be Franken tissues right now with Huvex and all sort and some stem cells. But the thing is that we are tackling this challenge of looking at human tissues and using them for drug screening and so many other potentialities of stem cells. So I hope we can find a way to be more collaborative, and instead of just shooting down new approaches, building bridges and starting collaborations with folks that are thinking about solving these problems in totally different ways. So I think that's a big challenge for our field.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I will say that I think I'm lucky here to be here at UCSD or UC San Diego that, you know, has really embraced collaboration with bioengineers and basic science, stem cell scientists. So it's been great, and it'd be great to see that everywhere. Okay, so that's the last of my questions. So I'd like to open it up to the audience. I think there's some mics roaming around if you want to raise it. And I think Kat the first question, and then raise your hand if anyone else has questions.
Well, I think this is very encouraging, and I think this is an honest assessment of how we try and get our stories out there, and not to overhype, but to promote the advances in science, incremental advances, so that people don't get this idea we've cured everything and the mouse is cured, but the people aren't. So my question is really about diagnostics and precision regenerative medicine, and how do we get people like Yanis, you know, working on the, you know, stepwise progression of a disease from an earlier stage to a frank leukemia or myeloid sarcoma, working with people who develop therapeutics, because at the moment it seems like we're in two different camps, the diagnostics and the therapeutics people, never the twain shall meet, or seldom the twain shall meet. How do we get that bridge to be formed more readily and do more of the, I've got to do a plug for A2Bio here because Will Go is our fellow, do more of the non-interventional study when it comes to clinical trials where we're looking, do they have the target, and then they graduate to the therapeutic trial. Is that something that we can bridge through publications? These papers fit together because one is a diagnostic, the other is a potential therapeutic. And sometimes you have all in one, but frequently you have papers that could connect. Is there a way to have more themes in our journals?
You can certainly submit papers as a package. So a co-submission where you are focusing on a particular disease, it might depend on the amount of interrelationships between the papers as to how, whether they would be considered as a package. But I think that that's actually really one way to address what you're saying. So you have one paper going after the diagnostics and the other one going after the pathway.
I think in single papers as well, like cancer research and clinician scientists, like you both, are really a good example of where we're starting to see this, right? So I hope that we can convince clinicians to start developing stem cell technologies at diagnosis and as they treat their patients. What we're seeing in cancer organoids as avatars for treatment is really exciting. And I hope that someday that can become kind of more standard practice. But I'm seeing a lot of development in that right now.
I think publication has a problem in that we want a relatively speaking self-contained story that we can fit within a certain whatever amount of space, number of figures, all of this sort of thing. And I frequently basically reject papers that try to do too much. Not because they're interdisciplinary, but because no particular bit is done well enough. And that's what your problem is. It isn't that people can't think across that bridge necessarily. It's that it's really hard to get all of those components done well enough at a level that they individuals want to pool their effort and only get one publication. That's just, I don't think that's realistic. Not the way people's careers actually do develop in the real world. You know, if you have students that want to get their first author paper, they're not going to allow you as their PI to fold that into a collaborative paper with the lab three doors down that's doing something really quite different, but with, in the end, a similar goal. I think joint publications can work. I think in the end, the secondary literature is the place that those things can be tied together. And that's what, you know, I don't know, forward-looking reviews, forward-looking perspectives can do to bring that stuff together. And conferences, multidisciplinary conferences can do that. But I'm not sure that it's a straightforward thing to say, you know, one paper should have, I mean, you know, everyone talks about bench to bedside, but there's an awful lot of steps in between bench and bedside, and I don't think there's very many individual papers that can really bridge that in one go.
I'm Tom Hudson. I'm currently in a VC firm, but I was in academia for a long time, part of big international cancer and genome projects, genetics. And I actually did, and I was editor for a Springer journal at some point in my life. I think standards, I was going to say, because I think the first comment that Stella mentioned about reproducibility is really important. It's really important in genetics. As we were sequencing, we're next-gen sequencing, everyone had different data because they were using different algorithms, normalizing differently. Same thing in gene expression. Over and over again, the field gets enamored by a couple of technologies, but then people are not reproducing each other's data. So standards come, and this is where the KOLs in the stem cell area, NIH, Wellcome Trust, others, they come together, and journal editors come together and say, what is the standard? Because everyone is publishing without measuring phenotypes differently, calling names differently, everything. It's actually very hard for the field to actually make a difference. And I've had certainly experience, at least in human genetics, where we were seven journals, wrote one paper, and we all published the same paper at the same time, on this is what we expected in a human genetic study. And what had to be like a check mark of things that had to be in every papers to get that reproducibility up. And I did it with NIH and Wellcome Trust in cancer genetics and other areas in big data. More than once, but I think that the more that the field is producing reproducible data with standards that actually the publishers recognize this is well done, they've actually met the standards. The funders and the scientists actually trust the data in the other paper. The more that we can do that, the more it's helpful for the field. I also learned one thing over time, because I've been in all these standard meetings for cohorts, is if people think standards is like a toothbrush, everyone needs one, but no one wants to use the other one's toothbrush. The other one. So I'm not talking, I really am being common standards, equivalents. It's really hard to actually come up with what those things are, but it actually helps that field move forward.
I think those are very good points, and we should commend Amanda here for the work that the ISSCR has done under her leadership in bringing standards to, that brought together large groups of people to think about how many lines do we need in a disease modeling paper to say that it's reproducible or a universal phenotype. And so the stem cell reports, one of our partner journals, has adopted a lot of the recommended standards and has a checklist for many of those things. And so, I struggle with this because I think there are certain kinds of papers where absolutely you need a certain number of lines, you need to have the standards, as you say. And then there are different types of scientific questions where, in fact, you're not going to do that. If you're making a therapeutic product and it's a cell line, it's just one, right? And so for certain types of questions, developing one thing really well ends up being quite useful as opposed to showing universality of a phenotype.
I agree, you need diversity for science to progress, but maybe it's in the area of going to clinical studies that would be the right place to, maybe you have them, and again, I'm not in the stem cell field right now, but I think I probably brought 50 different drugs to phase one in my last position. You need to. There's a lot of elements of quality of product, very different things that need to be addressed. And then when we were looking at stem cells or others, just to be able to say, is the mutation there? How do you quantify mutation load has gone down? The tumor has gone down. A lot of biomarkers. There's a lot of work need to be done to actually come up with standards for clinical studies, and maybe that's one place that I think that your institution, which you've done 30 trials, I think you've mentioned, another place that we might be able to get more trials done, approve, move forward, comparable, learn across studies, if we had kind of those types of standards that were well established.
Yeah, so Tom is being very self-deprecating there. He ran the Ontario Institute for Cancer Research and was a driving force behind our Canada-California Cancer Stem Cell Initiative. So that's what I was alluding to in terms of collaborative infrastructure and really looking at in whom, not just what the therapy is, at what time, and this is what I meant by precision regenerative medicine that I talked about at the White House with Janet Woodcock a few years ago. It's about applying the right therapy at the right time and the right person and not wasting their time. It's not an erudite or abstract endeavor. It's something that the FDA is going to require as a standard. So as we live in the land of Illumina and we start to develop these new therapeutics, and as we were hearing from Stella, the cost is crushing sometimes. It's just not possible to give a $2 million therapy to everyone. How do we know that we're applying it at the right time and the right person? This is what the FDA is going to require, and that standard is what's going to be applied. I think as we look at the cost of our therapies and the downstream cost of side effects, we're going to need to do this as a field. And I think as we start to see publications saying, yes, but in whom? And at what time in the stage of disease? And when is it too early? When is it doing harm as opposed to being efficacious. And now we have the molecular tools to do that, and we can apply them at the stem cell level. Thank you, Sheila, for recognizing that. And so what Sheila was alluding to are three papers we published with Sheila Chari and Cell Stem Cell, one on neural stem cell transplantation, so a pluripotent stem cell product for spinal cord injury, another one on the sirmatuzumab product, ROR1 targeting antibody, and we had a third one on the Alpha Clinics to say why it matters to work together to keep each other honest. We have 9 Alpha Clinics in the state of California, thanks to the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Just wanted the Alpha Clinic directors to put up their hands. Yeah, the clinical directors, the Alpha Clinic directors, we've got everybody here. The way to apply standards is to check each other's work and to have open access to the data. So when you go to the FDA in person, like I have been a couple of times, and I know, Tom, you've been there a lot more than I have, they want the mechanism, they want the proof of concept data, and they don't want to see that, oh, you're never going to pay attention to that again beyond phase one. They want to see that you're following that in the clinical trials. So I think it behooves all of us when we publish to think about what the companion diagnostic will be, not just for the therapy, but for the patient, because we're all going to be patients. So when would you consider having that therapy? And if this isn't a nice to have, I think it's becoming a must have, especially in these complex therapies when we use them together, in combination or in sequence. So I think that obviously I'm doing a strong push here because we have Illumina and all these sequencing technologies here. How do we get more of these papers out there? So we have a cellular product for type 1 diabetes. We heard from Yannis about inflammation. We know that that affects engraftment. Should we have a stem cell fitness test or inflammatory marker test before we start on these therapies? And really trying to throw down the gauntlet for all of us doing this, because it's fun to do trials, it's fun to get things into phase one, but often they die on the vine and they don't go to phase two or phase three. So I know that's a long-winded way of asking a question about the field of precision regenerative medicine, which is, if you're going to apply regenerative medicine, be precise about it and know how it's going to work and in whom. So how do we start to have that conversation? Or maybe it's a conversation that we can leave to engineers who are going to make the next technologies that can do this. But what do you think, Sheila? Or Robert? Or Stella?
Well, I think the first step is actually just to start to have the conversation. And so, you're talking about all the work that goes into applying for a clinical trial. And what I've observed is a lot of that incredibly difficult, careful work doesn't ever see the light of day outside of the IND application. And so something that we've opened up our pages to are a certain flavor of a paper, a clinical and translational report, and this is the translational part of those reports. And they're very dry papers, but they're important because they're essentially the IND enabling studies for bringing a therapy to product. So I don't know if that answers the when in the diagnosis question, but I do, or the diagnostics question, but I think at least we need to start being okay with putting that information out there, right? I think a lot of trials that are not investigator initiated but are sponsored by companies, maybe they're reticent to put that kind of data out there. And we need to push ourselves and each other to do that so that we can at least start having those conversations.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and I'm glad to hear that you all are doing it. Because if you go to the FDA, we all want the shiny efficacy data to go in one of your paper or journals. But the FDA, yes, they want to see that, but that's not what they're focusing on. It's really, the safety and IND enabling studies, so, which is hard as an academic, right? So I think that's a really, really excellent point.
And this is from a member of the audience online. Why are reviewers not paid?
Yeah. That is why.
The question, which is a little bit of a hot topic these just days on social media, is why are reviewers not paid? If you want to maybe just briefly, because it's not related necessarily specifically to stem cells, but...
Reviewers are not paid because it's a sort of community service. If you want your papers reviewed by people who are doing it not for the money but just for the good of science, you need to be able to do it. So it's a quid pro quo in the academic hierarchy, and people, now don't shoot me, but people generally are doing their reviewing when they're being paid to do whatever their job is, and part of their job is being a part of the academic community, and refereeing is part of that expectation of academics.
Thank you.
I'll close with an existential question related to the last one. So I was recently attacked on Twitter because I suggested that journals have some role to play in this era of open access. So I don't want to be attacked again, but I want to ask you if you think that indeed there is a role for journals to play these days as, science is changing and science communication is changing, et cetera, et cetera.
Science, with a capital S, has tried to be one of the good guys with respect to open access. So all our papers are available freely by a green open access model. So you can't pay to get your paper open access in science. You can put it up at PubMed yourself for free, but the sort of paywalled article stays behind the wall at Science. But the accepted version of the paper is out there for free to anyone who wants to find it. We can do that as long as the libraries still subscribe. Once in a different new world, if the libraries say, well, why would we pay for a subscription to Science? Because we can get all the stuff. It might not look as pretty, but we can get all the stuff by just doing a trawl online. Something we'll have to give. So I think the whole open access movement made a really big mistake when they said, we'll pay the publication costs to the publishers, because the commercial publishers just said, yes, give us your money. Why not? And why wouldn't they? It was like, motherhood and apple pie and all that, but these are commercial publishers. I mean, Science is not for profit, and we don't try to monetize the papers that we publish. But we still need some money to work.
If anybody else wants to answer.
I can speak to the kind of first part of your question, which is, do the journals have a role to play? And I think our privilege and our responsibility is to serve, to have a point of view, right? And to have a curatorial role for the community to say, look, this is important, and to be that fourth referee when we say what's enough, what's important for our field. We sit at this really a privileged position where we get to learn what's important and what the big challenges are in our field, and help translate that for the community. So I hope that even small journals like Cell Stem Cell have a role to play in influencing what people read, the problems that they tackle, and what gets funded, and even hiring decisions.
Is there maybe one last quick question?